From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I have rejected that in the past, and I reject it again. We have never conducted spying for anybody. We have used the resources at our disposal for the pursuit of our mandate to see that Iraq is properly disarmed in accordance with the decisions of the Security Council.
Was Saddam Hussein right? U.S. intelligence undercover of the U.N. spying on Iraq? We'll speak with the Boston Globe reporter who broke the story. Also, a profile of the new Speaker of the House. And why is Tom DeLay and other top House Republicans interested in Saipan? A look at indentured servitude in the U.S. Commonwealth. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon says an American fighter jet pilot attacked an Iraqi radar site today after realizing he was about to have a missile launched at him. The spokesman says the Air Force F-16 was patrolling the no-fly zone over northern Iraq at the time. The pilot determined a surface-to-air missile was about to be fired at his plane, so he attacked first. A high-speed anti-radar missile was launched at the site, though it's unclear how much damage it caused. The American plane returned safely to its base. Meanwhile, more on the expose yesterday that came out in the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, this today in the New York Times. Tim Weiner writes, United States officials said that American spies had worked undercover on teams of United Nations arms inspectors ferreting out secret Iraqi weapons programs. Iraq has long condemned the inspectors as tools of American intelligence. In October, it issued a statement saying it would never cooperate with United Nations teams riddled with, quote, American spies and agents. United States officials said American intelligence agencies provided information and technology to the United Nations Special Commission, known as UNSCOM. In turn, they said the United States and other nations received information on Iraqi weapons programs from the inspectors. By being part of the team, the Americans gained a firsthand knowledge of the investigation and a protected presence inside Baghdad. The New York Times goes on to say today intelligence gathering devices supplied to the inspectors by Washington gave the United States a better understanding of the sites at which Iraq developed and concealed weapons of mass destruction. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with the Boston Globe reporter who broke the story yesterday. Meanwhile, former U.N. weapons inspector Scott Ritter says he believes the United States had used information compiled by a U.N. commission to conduct its recent bombing raids on Iraq. Ritter said on Australian radio there was no doubt the United States had access to information compiled by UNSCOM about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and about Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. This information was then used in the December bombings of Iraq by the United States and Britain, codenamed Operation Desert Fox. Ritter told SBS Radio, I think it's quite obvious when you look at the facilities bombed by the United States in Operation Desert Fox that they were targeting locations based upon information that UNSCOM had developed. And let's look right now at what's happening on Capitol Hill. Despite last-minute bargaining to head it off, the Senate is pressing ahead with an impeachment trial for President Clinton, the first such trial in 130 years. Chief Justice William Rehnquist is swearing in the senators as jurors today, but it's still not clear how long the trial will last. Senators are still working on guidelines for the trial, including whether witnesses will appear. House prosecutors want to call Monica Lewinsky and presidential friend Vernon Jordan. Sources say Republicans are leaning toward a plan giving each side several days to present evidence. Then there would be a vote to adjourn the trial. If it fails, either side could seek to summon witnesses with a majority vote required for each. With a Senate impeachment trial formally opening today, the White House strategy is becoming clearer, and presidential advisors hope to use public opinion as one of their weapons. Aides are considering trying to stage an early vote in the Senate to show that the two-thirds majority required to oust President Clinton from office isn't there. If that happens, one official says, the White House can hammer home the point that it's a show trial with no chance of conviction. One White House official says a test vote could be forced by a comprehensive motion claiming the case doesn't meet the constitutional test of high crimes and misdemeanors. If that doesn't fly, a Democratic senator could make a motion to drop or postpone the trial before evidence is presented. And speaking of trials, this news from London, the Chilean government today asked to be allowed to have a say in a new hearing by Britain's House of Lords on the fate of former dictator Augusto Pinochet. Officials at the House of Lords, Britain's upper chamber of parliament, which acts as the highest court in the land, said lawyers acting on behalf of the Chilean government had lodged a petition asking for permission to make its case before the law lords later this month. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and since it's Thursday, it's Juan Gonzalez, my co-host. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And here we are in day 357 or so of America held hostage to the Lewinsky crisis and the continued investigations of President Clinton. It's almost a year now since this so-called scandal broke
January. You know the story well because I had just come back from Cuba and you had just gone down because the Pope had gone to Cuba and was meeting with Fidel Castro. And it was at that time, because all the news anchors raced out of Cuba, that you were there and you heard the story.
I think he was about to go. He hadn't even arrived yet when they started to pull out, right? Yes. And here we are a year later still. Still with the same nonsense.
And for people who have been speculating about what will happen, it seems it's always the most extreme. After the election, many speculated an impeachment vote would not go forward. And yet it did go forward. The president was impeached. Then they said, well, there's no question that they'll be going toward the compromise reached by Washington Senator Republican Gordon and Connecticut Democrat Lieberman. But in the end, that, too, looks like it has been scuttled and that a trial will take place, although negotiations are happening as we speak. But right now, before we start talking about what's going on in the House and the Senate, we're going to talk about the latest exposé that's come out of Iraq, come out of the United Nations, and come out of the Washington Post and the Boston Globe. For some time, the Iraqi government has charged that the United Nations Special Commission, known as UNSCUM, created by the UN Security Commission or UN Security Council to enforce Iraq, to force them to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction, was an intelligence operation under American supervision. Now, the Globe and the Washington Post allege that U.S. intelligence agencies gained information by using the UN as cover for its eavesdropping operations. UN head Kofi Annan was given convincing evidence that the United Nations Arms Inspector helped American intelligence in its spying operation. We're joined now by Colm Lynch, who is a correspondent with the Boston Globe, who broke this story yesterday. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Colm.
Oh, hi, Amy. How are you?
Very good. Can you lay out what it is that you first exposed yesterday?
There were sort of two fundamental issues. I mean, what came out yesterday was the disclosure that there had been an eavesdropping operation run out of UNSCOM's, out of the UN Weapons Inspector's headquarters in Baghdad. There are a couple of key issues. There was an effort, if you go back to February 1996, there was an effort by UNSCOM's executive chairman to try and come up with some sort of mechanism for countering Iraq's very successful efforts to hide its elements of its weapons of mass destruction. And so they came up with a lot of various ideas, reached out to various countries, including the U.S., Britain, Israel, and some others, and basically came up with this idea that, you know, if they're going to figure out what these guys are doing, they've got to basically crack this sort of veil of security that is responsible for hiding these things. So the Americans decided back then to provide UNSCOM with a number of pieces of equipment, some commercial scanners, the sort of things reporters use to track, you know, police communications and that sort of thing, and also set up a little operation in their headquarters with some people to do translations and other things. Basically what they did is they focused on a number of institutions that were not only involved in moving around the weapons, but also it was the same units that were basically involved in providing security for the president. And so the Americans, you know, UNSCOM claims, and Chairman Rolf Ukias, the former chairman of UNSCOM, claimed that this was an operation that, while it relied on information from British, U.S., Israeli intelligence, that it was primarily controlled by UNSCOM, and that intelligence information resources came in, but they never went back to the governments. And so there's nothing sort of scandalous from his point of view, in terms of, you know, the UNSCOM chief has the right to ask for those kind of intelligence resources from all governments. But the problem is how do you manage and control that stuff? And the problem was that they needed someone to interpret this stuff. It's very complicated. You get all sorts of elliptical messages. Some of the communications were on encrypted cellular telephones. And so much of the information was sent back to the United States, to the NSA, where they basically decoded the information. While the purpose was to get to the bottom of the weapons of mass destruction, they also came across lots of information about sort of the inner workings of Iraq's intelligence apparatus, and also, you know, the infrastructure that was used to move around to protect the president and that sort of thing. So it was basically the Americans had all the raw data and could do whatever they wanted with that information. The more controversial issue is what happened to that operation over time. I interviewed Scott Ritter, who had was at one point managing this operation. Everybody probably knows him. He resigned in August in protest that the U.S. was trying to sort of weaken U.N. inspectors' efforts to get tough with Saddam Hussein. But Ritter basically claimed that the eavesdropping operation was taken out of UNSCOM's hands and basically handed back to the Americans, and it was the Americans that were getting all of the information, and none of it was coming back to UNSCOM, and that this decision was made with the approval of the current chairman of UNSCOM, Richard Butler. So this is Butler has denied this, but there is more and more sort of reports and evidence coming out that this is the case. So basically, you know, Richard Butler sort of handed an UNSCOM intelligence operation over to the Americans, and the operation may still be ongoing, probably is still ongoing. However, at this point, they don't need the actual inspectors to do the scanning and the intercepts. They've sort of modified and they've sent some more advanced equipment. They're using more advanced equipment that allows them to do it, to do some of the scanning by remote control.
Well, Colin Lynch, I'd like to ask you, to what degree was Kofi Annan or other members of leadership of the United Nations aware of this? And also, what was the justification or the rationale for passing this work on to the United States rather than some other country that might be seen as more neutral in terms of deciphering or decoding going through the information gathered?
Well, I originally said, I mean, UNSCOM relies on sort of offers that it gets. I mean, you know, I can't remember whether it was Richard Butler, but one of the senior officials once said, you know, maybe we should have made a greater effort to reach out to other countries to give us this kind of information so that it wasn't so dominated by the Americans. Actually, it probably wasn't Butler, but it was somebody else in UNSCOM. I can't remember. But the Americans. I mean, I said that this thing was set up by UNSCOM, but I imagine that the Americans were encouraging UNSCOM to run this kind of operation and probably were offering all of these resources, and UNSCOM doesn't have a lot of money, needs to rely on the kindness of friends, and decided to go along with it. I think Ukias went to great lengths to try and maintain as much purity as possible in the system, but it was impossible to do. I mean, the sort of needs and demands from the guys who really knew how to interpret this stuff came from, you know, countries that were hostile to the Iraqis. And so I think that the Americans offered, they accepted, and wasn't quite clear whether there was somebody else who was capable of doing it as effectively or as quickly as the Americans. On the first question, Annan, the whole Annan's role in this, or supposed role in this, was not, I didn't even get into that, and I don't, I that was in the Washington Post story. But I think that the issue of Annan is not, did he know about it and did he not do anything about it? The concern is that Annan found out about it, according to the Post, and that, you know, basically moved to try and sabotage the operation, or, I mean, the Post didn't say that, but basically, you know, Albright called Annan in the morning and sort of suggested that he was undermining American policy. American officials in the White House suspect that Annan or his aides leaked a lot of the information that was published in my report and Bart Gellman's report in the Post. So there has been some.
Is it true?
Pardon me?
Is it true?
Well, I'm not going to tell you who I talked to, but Gellman in his article suggests what I can tell you is that the SG knew about the allegations. His senior aides knew about the allegations. What they are saying is that they did not have hard evidence, meaning classified information that proved that this was the case, that may be the case. But I think that they basically had they knew the gist of the story.
Colin Lynch, let's go to what Richard Butler had to say yesterday when confronted with these allegations that UNSCOM was being used as a cover for the U.S. to spy on Iraq, exactly what Saddam Hussein had been charging.
Right.
Iraq's position on our receipt of such assistance has been to call us spies, and I'm sure we'll probably hear more of that in the next few hours. I have rejected that in the past, and I reject it again. We have never conducted spying for anybody. We have used the resources at our disposal for the pursuit of our mandate to see that Iraq is properly disarmed in accordance with the decisions of the Security Council.
Right.
That was him.
Two things. He acknowledges that he uses intelligence resources from the U.S. and others. He has never spoken specifically about any of the operations to deny or to confirm them. So he's not saying that there wasn't a spying operation. What he is saying is that the information was not used to advance the goals of the American government. I think if you go back to February, I was talking about, you know, the role that the Americans played in assessing and kind of interpreting this information, that it would be naive to say that kind of role was not useful for the Americans and did not help advance their own roles. I mean, the sort of official goals were to, you know, get rid of the weapons of mass destruction to fulfill UNSCOM's mandate. But the reality was that information that was of use to the Americans who were interested in undermining the regime in Baghdad was being sent back to the United States intelligence community. So I think it's naive to say that this is all only being used for the purposes of getting rid of the weapons.
Shouldn't we also be realistic about what UNSCOM is? It's not a bunch of neutral people from different countries. It's the spies of different countries. I mean, Scott Ritter worked for Naval Intelligence during the Persian Gulf War, which is why Saddam Hussein wanted him out. And that's the case in each of the countries, right? It's often the intelligence people from each of these hostile countries.
Well, I don't think it's. I mean, I think you're right to a certain degree. I mean, I think that the Americans had spies. That worked under the cover of UNSCOM. And I'm sure the Russians and the French, and I'm sure many of the others did, and they were all pursuing their own goals and interests. So there were a lot of people, you know, in there looking for information for a variety of reasons with different sort of objectives in mind. But I think that by and large, there were a lot of very good people who aren't spies, who are professional arms experts, and who were quite, you know, who were really believed in the idea of creating this kind of international mechanism, this unprecedented thing, to try and do an extraordinary thing, which is to limit the development of the nastiest weapons on Earth.
Well, Colm Lynch, I want to thank you very much for joining us, correspondent from the Boston Globe. We do have to break for stations to identify themselves and remind our listeners that the Senate is about to conduct a trial of President Clinton, and I think Iraq will remain very much in the news. The latest news is that, once again, the U.S. aircraft have opened fire on Iraq, the latest news from the Pentagon, and I expect that this will continue to happen. U.S. officials saying a U.S. plane fired a missile at an Iraqi air defense site in the no-fly zone over northern Iraq. Can't help but connect the two. When President Clinton was just about to be impeached, hours before he began the four-day air raid on Iraq, and just an hour or two after he was impeached, he said that it was over, accomplished its mission, whatever that was, but said he would keep the troops in the Gulf. We could only think because a Senate trial was coming up. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn now to Congress, Representative Dennis Hastert was sworn in yesterday as the 51st Speaker of the House, and he offered his philosophy of government.
I believe in limited government, and each of us was sent here to conduct the people's business. And I intend to get down to business. That means formulating, debating, and voting on legislation that addresses the problems that the American people want solved.
That Dennis Hastert, the new Speaker of the House, very close ally of Tom DeLay, with whom he shares a suite of offices. We want to get a kind of profile of Dennis Hastert, so we thought we'd go to Washington and speak to Frank Clementi. He's the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch, and he's a former senior policy advisor for what was then the Government Operations Committee, now the Government Reform Committee. He worked there until the Republicans took over in 1994. He started in 1989. And working on that committee, he actually worked with Illinois Republican Dennis Hastert. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Frank Clementi.
Good morning. Good morning, Amy.
Well, it's good to be with you. It's very hard from the news coverage to get a sense of exactly what Dennis Hastert represents. In the New York Times today, it talks about his low-key workhorse style, an antidote to the inflammatory politics that have paralyzed the Capitol, described as grandfatherly, described as avuncular. But this man has politics, very clearly a close ally of one of the leaders of the House, Tom DeLay. Many say that this simply means that Tom DeLay has reached his ascendancy in the House. Can you talk a little about the Illinois Republican, Dennis Hastert?
Sure, Amy. I think the best way to get a sense of where a member comes from is to look at their voting record. And we went back, public citizen keeps a voting record for each session of Congress. We went back, looked from 1995 through 98, which is the 4 years that the Republicans have been in charge of the House of Representatives. And what you find in the last 2 years, his voting record was 16% on public citizen issues. Those are what I would broadly characterize as pro-consumer issues. He got 16% on our scorecard. And in the previous Congress, he got 7% on our scorecard. Probably the easiest way to characterize that is he probably gets what Newt Gingrich would get on our scorecard if Newt Gingrich was voting on measures in Congress. Typically, the Speaker of the House does not vote on measures. The Chamber of Commerce, by contrast, gave him a 100% scorecard the last couple of Congresses. The National Federation of Independent Business, which represents 600,000 small businesses across the country, also gave him a 100% voting record. And a number of other conservative groups, the Christian Coalition among them, also gives him virtually a 100% voting record. So if you look simply at the many votes that he takes in Congress, both conservative and liberal, he largely runs on the conservative perspective about 100% of the time.
Where has he stood on some of these issues, some of the major issues that have divided the Congress in recent years, things like NAFTA or where it hasn't been a clear-cut situation in terms of Democrats or Republicans, or, for instance, tobacco, continuing battle with the tobacco companies?
Sure, Juan. There's actually a number of votes in the last Congress that illustrate that. Campaign finance reform, first among them. 62 House Republicans crossed the line, voted with Democrats for the Shazmian campaign finance reform bill. This is not a public financing bill. It's a relatively modest but a very important bill that would ban soft money and control issue ads that are out there in campaigns. Hastert, he's the chief vote counter. He's the guy he's the deputy to delay. He was the guy who had to round up as many Republicans as possible to oppose that legislation. But 62 of his colleagues went the other way. Another government ethics issue, he even opposed a gift ban so that lobbyists could wine and dine to their heart's content and also continue to pay for members' vacation junkets. That actually was banned. It was achieved against Hastert's opposition. Back in 95, when he first came in and was the deputy whip counting votes, he was one of the lead architects for the Republican effort to cut Medicare by $270 billion in the budget bill. And they largely were doing that. Their way of doing it was to force folks into managed care plans. And they've been successful at that. There's now 15% of people in the Medicare program are in managed care right now. He's been a strong supporter of tobacco crop subsidies to keep the tobacco industry going. He wants to gut federal agencies that promulgate regulations that protect people's health and safety, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, OSHA, which protects our workplaces. He's very much a proponent of what they call regulatory reform, which is to dismantle the authority of agencies to enact new protections for folks. He also is a key proponent of efforts to take away people's legal rights. When the government fails us, as it often does, to protect consumers, we depend on the ability to go into court, to drag a corporation to court, much like the people did in the movie Civil Action that's now going to be out this coming weekend, where they took toxic polluters into court to try and get redress. He's been a chief proponent of taking away your legal rights to bring a car company that manufactures a defective airbag, a drug company that produces a bad pill, or a doctor who commits medical malpractice. He wants to take away your legal rights to bring them to court. And then on the free trade agenda, which you were talking about, he's what I would characterize as a corporate free trader, and he is against what we consider to be the right way to go, which is worker fair trade. So he has been pro-GATT, pro-NAFTA, pro-fast track, pro-most favored nation status for China. Those are the four big trade votes, that corporate free trade votes that Congress has taken. Hastert has been on the anti-worker, anti-consumer, anti-environment side of all those votes.
Frank Clemente, you've had personal experience with the new Speaker of the House. Before you were director of Public Citizens Congress Watch, you were the senior policy advisor for the Government Operations Committee, which is now the Government Reform Committee. And on that committee, you worked with Hastert. In fact, you went on a trip with him to Canada to look at their health care system.
Yes, our committee was we commissioned the General Accounting Office, that's the auditing arm of the Congress, to do a major study on the Canadian healthcare system. And then we did 3 days of hearings on that on their report. It actually was a very favorable report. It said that if the U.S. adopted a comprehensive national healthcare program like Canada, we would save about $80 billion a year, which would have been enough to cover everybody who lacked health insurance at that time. And the next stage, we decided to put a delegation of members of Congress to go up to Canada to look into their health care system. Our idea was we were going to try and put a report together from the committee based on the General Accounting Office report and an investigation of the Canadian health care system. Speaker Hastert came along on that delegation. He was very thoughtful in terms of the questions he asked. But I would characterize it as not having a terribly open mind. It was very clear at that point in time, and we're talking here now, the early, 1991, he had a very free market orientation to the healthcare system. We met with a CEO of a major hospital in Toronto, and this person was a displaced American. He came to Canada. He had been running a hospital in Hastert's district down in Illinois. He came, was running this major hospital in Toronto, and basically said how spent a half hour, or hour telling us how bad it was administering a hospital in the United States because of essentially the corporatization of healthcare and how much better it was in terms of delivering good quality healthcare to patients under the Canadian system. And Hastert was not at all open to what this person was saying. He found it incredulous what he was saying and just constantly was barraging him with questions that were trying to defeat his point of view.
So what do you – in terms of the way he's been presented, he's been presented as a refreshing change from the ideologues that have been House speakers or at least Gingrich and then Livingston, who never got to be House speaker, the choices of the Republicans have taken in the past. Do you see this as essentially a correct perspective on him, or is it actually that he's just a little bit better at hiding his ideology?
I think, Juan, it's a little hard to tell right now. In some ways, I compare Hastert to George Bush after Ronald Reagan. Remember, we had 8 years of Reagan, which very strong ideology, right-wing ideology, especially for the first 4 years of Reagan's presidency. And in some way, Bush was a tonic for the country. Remember his campaign slogan, he came in as being kinder and gentler. And that was relatively receptive to the American public because of the exhaustion of the extremism of the Reagan years. I think in some ways this is what we have with Hastert. There was 4 years of intense ideological warfare in the House and in Congress, largely led by Gingrich, really a slash-and-burn tactician, a real visionary. And I think that everybody from the public at large to the Democrats to the people, the press here in Washington, to people within his own Republican caucus got burnt out on that kind of politics. I think that the election in 98 scared them. There's a great fear among Republicans that they may lose the House in 2000. Remember, they were out of power for 40 years up until the 94 election. I think that they got tired of the lightning rod politics of Gingrich. But where Hastert is very similar, but again, quieter, kinder, gentler, he is without a doubt in the same camp as Gingrich, pro-free market, just a very strong free market ideology without his baggage. My corporate analogy would be Gingrich was like Federal Express and Hastert is like the U.S. Post Office. I think Hastert, the real question here is whether Hastert is going to be able to deliver his caucus on key issues. It's a very divided caucus, probably more divided than the Democrats were when they lost in 94. You have the religious conservatives who are the grassroots activists in the party and command are very influential in the primaries, and a lot of the political battle is going to be fought in the presidential primaries starting really this year. And then the other major camp you have is essentially the oligarchs, the huge financial interests that fund the Republican Party, that often have an agenda that is – it's an economic agenda as opposed to a religious conservative social agenda. And they have a different idea about what the Republican Party ought to do. And Hastert has to wrestle with those two huge tensions and get his House reelected as the majority in the year 2000. I think it's a difficult task. I think that his inclination would be to try and get some things done, Whether his caucus will allow him to do that, I think, is unknown.
Well, we're going to move on right now to talk about the man, well, really behind Denny Hastert, who is the new Speaker of the House, the 51st Speaker of the House, Tom DeLay. And I just want to ask if, Frank Lemeny, you have any last comments you'd like to leave with us, especially around Tom DeLay, who is the real force right now in the House, with Livingston stepping down, with Newt Gingrich, of course, leaving, and you have, or having left, I should say, and Dick Armey. DeLay and Armey are the powerhouses right now.
Two very conservative members of Congress from Texas, representing Armey more represents the corporate, ideologically, the corporate conservative wing. DeLay is the man who raises huge sums of money from corporate interests in Washington, from lobbying interests. He has developed the nickname of the hammer because of the technique. He's taken the art of shaking down political action committees to a much higher level than anybody else ever has. He's directly tying it to whether or not a corporate legislative agenda gets considered in the House of Representatives or not. It used to be that it was done in a very subtle way, no longer the case with Tom DeLay, threatening that lobbyists will never be able to appear in his office or the offices of other leaders in the Republican Party if they don't cough up sufficient amounts of money. It is the ultimate in the corporatization of our Congress, I would say, life under Tom DeLay. Hastert actually was the fellow who ran Tom DeLay's campaign in 1995, which to make Tom DeLay the whip, the number three ranking member in the Republican leadership. So they have a relationship that goes back then, collaborating, but actually goes back till 1987, when Hastert first came into Congress. He and DeLay both served on the Government Operations Committee. They have a longstanding relationship. As you said before, they share their offices. They also have shared their staff. And the fact that Hastert was elected so quickly, lightning fast speed, essentially, no other people dared challenge him because he was able to lock the votes up so quickly. People do attribute that to Tom DeLay's handiwork.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Frank Lemeny. We are also speaking on an historic day as the Senate now, the senators are being sworn in as jurors, first time in, what is it now, 130 years that a president will be tried by the Senate. Do you have any final thoughts on that? As a man yourself who worked in Congress for a number of years, now you're a watchdog outside of Congress. Are you shocked by what we're looking at today?
I think, yes. We've descended into hell, I guess I would say. Really, we've gone very far down the into the abyss, and I think folks generally don't know how to get out of this. There's pressure on each side, particularly on Lott at this point. I think Lott genuinely sees it not in his interest to continue a trial in the Senate, but the pressure that has built up with the House Republicans, Judiciary Committee members who are largely come from the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and from the religious conservatives outside the Beltway pushing Lott, and also conservatives within his own party in the Senate. I think he doesn't know how to extricate himself from this, but I think it really is a sad position for our government and for the American people, because not a heck of a lot is going to get done this year.
And that certainly affects the kind of work that you do, as you are major lobbyists in Congress around good government issues. Frank Lemeny, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Director of Public Citizens Congress Watch and former Senior Policy Advisor in the House for the Government Operations Committee, where he worked with Dennis Hastert, now the 51st Speaker of the House. And today, the Senate will formally receive the 13 House prosecutors and hear the charges against the president, those 13 House prosecutors who will try the case against President Clinton, include Henry Hyde, who is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Congressmembers James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, Republican, Republican Bill McCollum of Florida, George Geekus of Pennsylvania, Charles Kennedy of Florida, Steve Boyer of Indiana, Ed Bryant of Tennessee, Steve Chavit of Ohio, Bob Barr of Georgia, Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, Chris Cannon of Utah, James Rogan of California, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Well, I might be a liar, and I might be a thief, might take the path of least resistance when I'm seeking some relief. I might do anything for money and still don't got me none, but at least I ain't a Republican. At least I ain't a Republican. Well, I might call in sick to work and then go out and play. I might roll the dice and lose all night and cheat at cards all day.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. And Juan, you have a very interesting column in the New York Daily News today entitled A Faraway GOP Scandal.
Yes. Well, the essence of the column is basically in my lead. I say when it comes to obstructing justice and covering up sex scandals, Tom DeLay, the Republican majority whip from Texas, makes Bill Clinton look like a piker. And basically, I use that as an introduction to get into the whole issue of the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas, of which there have been some national press coverage, especially last spring. Around the time that Congressman George Miller of California issued a stinging report called Beneath the American Flag, Labor and Human Rights Abuses in the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Islands. And Tom DeLay has played a crucial role in basically covering up and refusing to even hold hearings or to press for the Republican Party to allow the House of Representatives to look into what is going on in this little-known, faraway part of the United States, because it is American soil, and all of its inhabitants, the indigenous people of the Northern Marianas, are American citizens.
We should talk a little about what comes out of the Northern Marianas, particularly Saipan. Actually, about 8 years ago, I went to Saipan. I went there to interview a judge, and it looks like, on the surface, a paradise on earth. The water around it is just crystal clear. They're snorkeling. It's an amazing place. I flew there from Guam. House Republicans who know the value of free enterprise love Saipan for a very different reason. They see it as a model of what government should look like. And it's very interesting to note that on this place, where there are many workers that are brought in by Chinese companies and other government companies, are brought into Saipan to work in factories where they make clothes that say made in the USA, because this is a U.S. territory, Saipan. We're joined right now by two people who know this story well. Marie Howard is on the Democratic legislative staff of the House Resources Committee. She works with George Miller, who put out this report and worked extensively on the report Beneath the American Flag. And we go to Saipan to a private attorney named Ken Govendo, who has represented a number of the people who work in these factories. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with
Good
Marie
morning,
Howard.
Thank you.
Good to be with you, Marie. Tell us about what you found and what the connection is between the mainland United States and the factories that produce many of the clothes that people wear in this country for companies like The Gap and Ralph Lauren and Oshkosh and others on Saipan.
Well, just as a quick going back, after the World War II, there were several islands in the Pacific that were taken away from Japan and put under UN's trustee status, and the United States became the administrator for those islands in deciding what was going to happen with them. And those on the Northern Mariana Islands made it very clear that they wanted to be a part of the United States. And so they have then been brought in. There was an act passed called the Covenant that was that brought them into the United States family, made them American citizens, and also set up the whole structure. And what has been somewhat normally done is there are provisions put in with most of the U.S. territories. As you mentioned, they are U.S. territories, so you have to think of them in the same way that you would think of Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, or Guam. Although very little is known about the Northern Mariana Islands. And typically, and not surprisingly, the United States said you don't need to come in under federal minimum wage laws. You can start off at a lower rate until your economy has a chance to build up. This has been done in all of the territories and very successfully so. This is the only one that has not done so well. The other provision that was a little different was an agreement made that the United States would allow the CNMI to control its own immigration. The agreement was that during the time they were still in UN trustee status, which was expected to be about 10 years, that they could control their own immigration. The only reason this was agreed to by the United States was because of the great fear in the Northern Marianas that they, at the time, this is 1975, only had about 15,000 people. They were very much afraid that, being their location so close to Asia, that they would be flooded by Asians allowed to come into the United States, and that it would destroy their very delicate culture. So this was agreed. And so these provisions that started off as an agreement to assist, obviously, the new U.S. citizens and their economy to build them up and have them become more a part of the United States has unfortunately mutated into a haven for Asian sweatshops and, as you said, an abuse of the Made in USA label. What was done was slowly but surely and building more strongly, they used that immigration control to bring in tens of thousands of foreign workers from Asia, from different countries, and predominantly now from China to build up these garment factories. The garment factories, in the most part, are owned by Asian corporations and Asian governments. Very few are owned by Americans. And they bring in their workers from China, and their fabric is made in China. So what you end up having are these Chinese-owned factories, and there have been reports, some good reports done, where the Republic of China actually owns factories. And they have bring in their workers. They have their labor bosses walking up and down the aisles. The workers are all Chinese citizens. The fabric is Chinese. And, as you say, they're sewing Made in the USA label into the fabrics, all of that, and then comes into the United States duty-free and quota-free. So it's been turned into a scam to usurp the U.S. quota systems and tariff systems.
Well, I'd like to...
Yeah,
Marie, I'd like to bring in Ken Govendo just for a little bit here. And Ken Govendo, in Congressman Miller's report and also in a report of the Department of Interior, which has also looked at the Clinton administration, has also looked into the situation there. There are allegations of tremendous amount of human rights and labor abuses from people not being paid for overtime, these immigrant workers living in barracks conditions where they're not even permitted to leave the barracks when they're on their off hours without permission. Could you tell us a little bit about what the situation, the conditions that these thousands of immigrant workers from China, Bangladesh, and other countries are living in the Commonwealth?
As far as the living conditions, where the people are actually living, they're horrible. Even in the best garment factories, These are crowded barracks. I saw one room that looked like a typical college dormitory room once, except that there were three bunk beds and one single bed in it. So that means there were seven girls living in that one room. The Bangladeshis are living in absolute hovels, except they're not in the garment industry. They came over here with promises of jobs in construction and hotel industry, and were abandoned as soon as they got over here. And so they're now they're doing lawn work and things like that. Most of the workers here, whether they're working in the garment industry or the construction industry, unless they're working for a hotel where the working conditions are or the living conditions are pretty good, are living in very inadequate housing that is shameful to find under the American flag. And a lot of the government people who know about this, I've heard many times these government people say, well, it's better than where they come from in China or the Philippines. And my response to this, how do you know? I mean, even if they're poor and they come from some rural area of the Philippines, it might be a very nice, clean, thatched hut with a dirt floor, and you walk outside and there's palm trees and papaya trees and coconut trees and things like that. That's better than living in a dingy hole with 50 other laborers, many of them who have pulmonary disease.
What about the allegations that many of the women who are brought over and basically have to pay thousands of dollars to contractors to come in search of jobs end up being forced into prostitution into a large sex industry for tourists there?
We have a huge sex industry here, and it's almost all Chinese, and none of these workers came over as tourists, and they certainly didn't come in and put down on their entry visa that they were coming over to work as a prostitute. So the general opinion is they came over in the garment industry, and whether they ever whether there was ever intention for them to be garment workers, I don't know. I mean, they could have come over with the intention of being prostitutes and just another way of making money.
Let's talk about how this fits into the larger political scene also here in Washington. And I do want to say people should listen carefully to what is happening there when we're talking about the big labels that we are that do say made in the USA, because next week there's going to be a federal lawsuit filed in Los Angeles against some of the largest garment manufacturers in this country. And when the rest of the media is going to be focused on that Senate trial, you'll have a heads up on why it is that these corporations, very familiar names, are being sued. Marie Howard, you're in Washington. You pass Tom DeLay often in the halls. Can you talk about his special connection and why he hails Saipan and CNMI in general as a kind of political paradise and what his connections are to a corporate lobbying group in Washington, D.C.?
The surprise certainly to us came when we had been working on a very bipartisan basis on the problems that were just beginning out there. It had never been a Democrat or Republican issue. We had Republicans very interested. It was after the Republicans took over that the government of the CNMI hired a law firm, a big law firm that's actually out of Seattle, Preston Gates, that's very big in Washington, handling a number of issues, and they immediately started taking staff trips, Republican-only staff members out to the CNMI, and they started with Congressman DeLay and Congressman Army and Congressman Gingrich staff and bringing them out there. Shortly after that, time of return. One of Mr. DeLay's top staffers, as has been noted in the press, left his office to work for Preston Gates on this issue. And around that time, yes, things certainly did change, where we suddenly came up against brick walls in trying to even get hearings on some of these issues.
And in terms of a delay heading out there, or Dick Armey, were they in committees that had anything to do with the situation in the Northern Marianas? As George Miller obviously is on the Resources Committee that deals with this issue.
No, they're not. The Resources Committee, House Resources Committee, does have the primary jurisdiction over all of the U.S. territories, and it is the committee that has passed out all of the legislation dealing with the Northern Mariana Islands. Obviously they were in the House leadership, and we were actually quite interested and thinking this was going to be great if we had a lot of leadership support assuming, of course, they would go out there and see what was going on and come back and want to help make some changes. And so Congressman Miller immediately wrote to Mr. Armey after his staff had said in the paper that he would be putting in a report and that they would be working on the issues, and wrote to him and asked that they work together on the issues and look forward to doing so. And we never received a response, and eventually stopped getting. No one would return the calls from Mr. Armey, and unfortunately, Mr. DeLay, Congressman Miller, this November also wrote to Mr. DeLay asking again for them to work together on solving the problems out there. But as of yet, there's been no response to that letter.
Well, I did a search of campaign finance records in the last couple of days, and found that the lobbyist for Preston Gates, Jack Abramoff, and his wife have donated $18,000 to DeLay, either to his campaign committee or to his political action committee in the last several years, in addition to contributing thousands of dollars to some of the other major Republican figures in the House. And DeLay, of course, went there a year ago, all expenses paid by the government of the Northern Marianas, along with his wife, his daughter, several aides of his. I'd like to ask Ken Govendo, what's been the reaction there of those people who are advocating for workers to see these Republican leaders or their staff members go to your Commonwealth, all expenses paid by the government, and come back and defend these labor practices?
There's really been no reaction here at all. As far as the government people who like the garment industry and are paid by the garment industry, they were absolutely delighted. This was a great coup in bringing Tom DeLay out. But a couple of the things, let me give you a little background.
Ken, actually, we don't have time for background. We have 10 seconds, so a final comment.
Okay, I want to say that, well, the CNMI has got the 24th largest garment industry in the world. Made in the USA is on the labels, and they're not touched by Americans at all. And if this is a model of democracy, how come all Americans work for the government and all other work, from waiters to waitresses to truck drivers, are done by foreigners? What kind of democracy is that what Tom DeLay wants?
Ken Govendo, I want to thank you for being with us. Marie Howard from the Democratic Legislative Staff of the House Resources Committee, thank you for being with us. The report out is called Beneath the American Flag, the companies that make those Made in the USA labels and the clothes on Saipan, Ralph Lauren, The Gap, J. Crew, Oshkosh, Nordstrom, and others. Thanks for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I'm Mark Cooper.